Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Recently, I spoke with Craig Lazara, Managing Director and Global Head of Index Investment Strategy for S&P Dow Jones Indices, about the research that suggests that it is, in short, very difficult to outperform the average when you're managing money. We talked in that conversation about the characteristics that investors might look out for if they do wish to invest with an active manager. But today's Craig's going to detail some of the ways that fund managers may try to attract your investment dollars and whether or not those methods are necessarily a good guide to their likely future for performance or even an accurate guide to their past performance. Craig, thanks so much for joining me.
Delighted to be here.
So Craig, firstly, can you talk about past performance and why it seems to play such a critical role in helping people make decisions?
Gemma, in most of life, past performance is a good indicator of future results. I'm visiting Australia. I anticipated when I got here that the cars would drive on the left side of the road. How did I know that? Because the last time I was here, that's what happened. Mm. I think from an evolutionary standpoint, I can easily imagine our distant ancestors living in caves understood that if the saber-toothed tiger was roaming, you stayed in the cave and kept your club near at hand, because if you didn't, you got attacked and killed. So the notion that past performance would be a guide to the future is not a bad notion at all in most of life. Now, it happens not to be true in investment management. We mentioned in our last podcast the results of a study that we do called SPIVA, S-P-I-V-A, stands for S&P Index versus Active. And what the SPIVA study demonstrates, along with many other studies of similar character, is that if you look at a database of actively managed funds, the average manager much more often than not underperforms an unmanaged index that is indicative of the same style of management. Furthermore, if you find a manager who's above average last year, the probability that he'll be above average this year or next year is no better than 50-50. In fact, in some instances, even less. So the burden of all the data going back, it really to 1932, that's the earliest study I'm aware of, a lot of studies coming from the 70s and forward, the burden of all the performance data is two things: that the average manager fails or underperforms most of the time, and secondly, that when you find success, it tends not to persist. That means that investment management is very different from most of life, and I think that explains in part why investors very often are eager to find active managers or are eager to embrace past performance, because in most of life, as I say, that's fine. Just not here.
It makes sense. Yes, you imagine that, and it's true of markets as well. You know, the ASX did well last year, therefore I assume it will do well this year, as opposed to it went a little bit too well last year and perhaps not so much. So how indicative exactly is past performance of future performance for a fund manager, or a market for that matter?
The quick answer is not at all. Let's cut to the chase. Not really at all. And that's the burden of what we call our persistence scorecard, where we explicitly look for both the U.S. and Australia and say, all right, let's suppose I have a manager. Say we have 10 years of data for Australia, and I have a manager who's in the top quartile in the top 25% in the first five-year period. How likely is it that they'll be in the top quartile in the second five-year period? And the answer is typically no better than 25%, which is to say it's random. Very often it's somewhat more likely that a manager will fall from the top quartile to the bottom quartile than that he will remain in the top. So at the manager level, there's very little, if any, evidence of persistence. At the market level, again, from a tactical timing standpoint, if it were the case that in a market that were above average last year also tended to be above average this year, we could all be rich from market timing, because all we'd have to do is look back and say, oh, who did the best last year? I'll invest there.
Yeah.
And in fact, as you know very well, I haven't found anybody yet who's gotten rich from timing, at least not of that sort. So it's a very difficult thing to do, because the degree of randomness in investment results is just so great that doing easy things like looking at last year's performance is just as likely to mislead you as to put you on the right path.
We talked in the previous podcast about, you know, some of the very, very famous investors who've survived decades, and people do fixate upon those individuals. You know, it's very nice to see a person who you believe can do this very well. We also talked about survivorship bias, and it's worth noting, you know, funds management teams, and they are generally a team. It's very rarely just one person. When they are doing active management, there will be researchers and analysts, and they will take inputs from various other people. The likelihood of any team surviving intact for even a decade, I mean, you're talking about periods of five years, you know, sporting teams don't perform consistently over decades, you know, to find a team that wins consistently, unless we're talking about the All Blacks, which I don't want to talk about.
They seem to be consistently
very, very good. There might be some unique characteristics there. But there are teams, you know, that will do very well for a short period, but then things change. And I think it's worth noting that investment teams are just people.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, to your point, a more successful team is less likely to continue in its current form than a less successful team, mm-hmm. simply because the analysts who support a more successful team are more likely to be recruited for competitive firms or to become portfolio managers themselves. So the dynamic is hard. I mean, whereas the teams that are not doing well are probably more likely to stay together and intact, which is, of course, not the team you want, but
not
but
necessarily
there.
What you're looking for. It's a really good point, isn't it? Very true, your point about very high quality managers within a team. Often we fixate on the star or the primary portfolio manager, but there'll be a person or two sitting underneath them doing a spectacular job, and eventually that person will want to go out on their own, and so the team splits and you see this new business emerge, and you know, some money will go with them perhaps, and all those sorts of things. So it's interesting looking at it as an organic process. It's not just about the maths. There are people involved, fact that people are involved has a lot to do with the fact we are not consistent
clearly.
Over time.
I mean, the behavioral, I mean, there's a whole branch, as you know, I mean, a whole branch of economics and finance that is called behavioral economics, behavioral finance, and it deals with, I'll say it this way, classical economics assumes that we're all perfectly rational decision makers.
Yes.
We would never do something that was irrational because it's not in our interest to do it. And behavioral economics starts with the proposition, well, we're, as you say, we're all people first, and as people we have systematic things that we, I think the technical term is cognitive biases in lay terms. It's mistakes that we make all the time. I mean, for example, overconfidence is one that many behavioralists focus on. If you take go out to our trading room here and ask all the people in the trading room, are you an above average driver or not? Guaranteed, there are no below average drivers. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one ever identifies as that. You know, professors will say, you know, there are no below average. I'm a better than average lecturer, for example. That's very common. It's you know, something we do. And so it's not surprising in the investment world, especially someone who's done well will believe with true conviction that he is above average. And if investors and customers are not aware of the magnitude of the fluctuation in statistics, they'll be inclined to believe it.
So the question I wanted to ask you then is, it's in managers' best interest to appeal to our natural tendency to look for strong performance. So we're looking for someone who's going to be able to do a great job for us. And managers are obviously very keen to seek that additional dollar from someone who's trying to do that. So can you talk us through some of the ways that they represent what they've done and how you can avoid your own cognitive bias?
Well, yeah.
To ensure that you're not going to fall for what you've called performance trickery, which I think is a great term.
Yeah, no, What I call performance trickery revolves around a certain way of presenting long-term results. So, for example, let's say you have a manager who's done indifferently for 2, 3, 4 years, and then has a spectacular year. He does whatever he touches turns to gold. He has a really good year, maybe two really good years. If you looked at year-by-year performance, you would see somebody who does, he's a little above, a little below, really good year, a little above, a little below. So you'd recognize the one really good year as an exceptional event. Or if there's a really bad year, you'd recognize that as an exceptional event, perhaps. What the manager may well do, and I've seen this happen many times, is that he will present not year-by-year data, but he will present his record for the last 1 year, when he did really well, for the last 5 years, for the last 10 years, never disaggregating year-by-year. For example, in his 5-year history, 20% of the numbers are from the one spectacular exceptional year. So unless you're very attuned to that, and the reason it's tricky, I mean, obviously, if you want to look at performance numbers, you should look at as long a time as possible. The reason it's what I characterize as trickery is because it erases the first 9 years of the data and just blends it in with the spectacular results in year 10. Investors who are shown cumulative performance numbers, whether it's 5 years, 3 years, 10, whatever it is, should try very hard to disaggregate and say, I appreciate that you've given me your 10-year number. I'd like to see each of the 10 years, because that may tell a very different story than simply looking at the one number.
It's worth noting also, in our last conversation, you were talking about the fact that, even at the beginning of this conversation, that a fund manager who outperformed last year has a less than average chance of outperforming this year, yeah. Which is quite astonishing when you think about it. So if you are looking at disaggregated numbers, a bad year last year may not be a bad thing.
If you're looking at disaggregated numbers, it's okay, but the trouble is, someone who's done badly last year is not going to show you his 10-year record.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be dragged down by the bad year.
So
you might see the disaggregation. It's the place where you'll see the aggregated numbers is for someone who has recently done well, and it's your task as a potential consumer to try to break that down. We'll come back to the notion that you raised just now of why is it? I mean, we ask this all the time. I mean, active managers are smart people, and they work really hard, and they're well trained, and they have tremendous financial incentives to do well. Why is it that they don't, by and large? But there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, one of them we discussed last time is cost. You know, obviously, if you're charging more for your services, it's less likely that you'll outperform. Another is what I will sometimes call the professionalization of investment markets, and what I mean by that is in hypothetically, in 1955 in the United States, most assets were controlled by what I will call undiversified amateurs. Only a minority were controlled by professional investors. In that environment, the great majority, theoretically all of the professional managers, can outperform, because the source of their outperformance is the underperformance of the amateurs. Well, when you evolve to a point, as we have in the US or you have here in Australia, where the majority of assets are managed by professionals, it becomes much harder for a professional to consistently outperform other people who went to the same schools, the same training programs, have access to the same data just as fast as he does. It's a bit of a crude analogy, but one I like to make is that the lion always catches the slowest zebra in the herd. And after the lion catches the slowest zebra, the average speed of the herd goes up because the slowest one is taken out. Well, it's the same in investment management. When there is a passive alternative, it's the least capable active managers who lose the most assets, which means the active managers who remain are better than they were before. If I think anecdotally in my own experience, the average active manager today is certainly far better than the average active manager 30 years ago. He's got better information access, better information, faster information, better able to do quick computations, much more knowledge of financial theory. You know, all of these things make him better than his counterpart from 30 years ago. The one thing he doesn't have is a time machine, because he can't compete against the guy from 30 years ago. Yeah. He can only compete against his contemporaries today. And one way to say it may be that the growth of passive has made active managers in general better. When active managers become better, it's harder for them to outperform. So there's this reinforcement of the tendency of active managers to underperform.
That's quite a fascinating way of looking at it. I think it's extremely insightful to point out to people that, you know, when you do invest with a professional manager, you know, you're talking to people who are incredibly professional now.
Yes.
You know, the caliber of information they have access to is extraordinary. Well, I was thinking about you talking about doing the research in 1932. It would have been with a pencil.
It was with a pencil.
Astonishing, yes. Trying to do that kind of analysis back then, when now you press a button, it's done for you. You know, automatically updates every quarter, as opposed to one or two individuals, you know, fact checking every number themselves and so on. Must have been incredibly challenging.
I'm sure it was very laborious, which I think is why you didn't see many subsequent
the longitudinal studies until
computers came along. It became much easier to do.
More straightforward, but then also the process of investing became much more professional, which is quite valuable.
Exactly.
So for investors who are looking at this range of very professional, very high quality investment opportunities available to them, but being aware the likelihood of getting a better outcome by using them is not that high, how can they arm themselves to ensure, if you're going to make that kind of choice, that you are doing it as well informed as possible?
Well, there are, I guess, two things at least to worry about, Gemma. One is, as you just said, be aware that the odds are against you. I mean, there's great power in that. I mean, when you talk to a professional advisor, financial planner, or whatever, be aware that the likelihood that they are going to pick stocks that will outperform the S&P ASX 200 is probably less than 50%. The same in the U.S. The chance of you're picking a manager who's going to beat the S&P 500 is less than 50%. If you want to try, your money, but go ahead. But be aware. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and this relates to the whole notion of the evolution of passive management. The second thing is to be aware that there are options in between pure passive, say ASX 200 or S&P 500. There are options in between pure passive and pure active, and they're typically referred to as I like to say factor indices. The term that's often used is smart beta, which is a term that everybody in the industry despises, but we all are compelled to use because we know customers. Yes,
yep.
People. Journalists told me years ago that the reason the term was so popular is because it fit into a headline easily. Smart beta. But the notion let me draw the contrast. The original generation of indices, S&P 500 or the All Ordinaries then in Australia or other indices like that, are capitalization weighted and designed to replicate an asset class. Mm-hmm. Factor indices are designed not to replicate an asset class, but to deliver a pattern of returns that investors, or access to a factor that investors might find congenial. So when I say factor, I mean it in the academic sense of an attribute with which excess returns are associated. So, you know, Fama and French in the 1990s said that small size and cheap valuation were factors of return. Mm. Momentum is a factor of return. Low volatility, quality tend to be thought of as factors of return. And we have done that research in the U.S. and Australia and elsewhere, and those things seem to be fairly persistent. Now, to give you an example, a low volatility, which is, as an index provider, I always say we have to treat all the indices. They're like children. You have to love them all the same. Except
yes.
Low volatility is really my favorite. What low volatility indices, we construct them very simply. So in the S&P 500, it's the 100 least volatile stocks in the S&P 500. What low vol is designed to do is to give you protection in bad markets. Now, it's not perfect protection. You can still lose money if the market's down. And participation in rising markets. And again, it's not perfect participation. You won't go up as much. The market's up 30, you'll go up 20 maybe. But by giving you that muted pattern of returns, you do two things. It does two things. One is that it enables investors to stay with their equity investments longer. I mean, one of the worst mistakes that investors made here, U.S., everywhere that we've looked, is they'll invest in something that's you know, the S&P 500, ASX, there's something where there is risk. And then the market will go down, and they'll see the risk, and then they realize, oh my goodness, I can't stand this, and so they sell at exactly the wrong time. So by protecting or muting the downside, low volatility strategies make it less likely that investors will give up at the wrong time. The other advantage is that strategies like low volatility, quality is another like that, or a lot of yield strategies, take advantage of what the professors will call the low volatility or low beta anomaly, which is that less volatile stocks over time tend to outperform the market as a whole. It's a factor like value and small size. And so you can take advantage of that. Now, we developed the S&P 500 low vol index in 2011, and I can tell you we were not inventing defensive equity investment in 2000. I mean, it's been around for longer than I have, certainly. But what these indices, factor indices, let you do is to, I like to use the word, indicize. They let you indicize active strategies, meaning to get in passive form a strategy that you formerly had to pay active fees to get. And so as investors think about speaking to active managers, they might consider two things that factor indices do. One is that it gives them an alternative to pure passive or pure active. They could have a conservative pattern of returns with low vol or an aggressive pattern with momentum indices, for example. And the second thing it lets them do is to have a benchmark, even if they want an active management strategy, to have a more appropriate benchmark against which to compare that manager. So if a manager is a specialist in if he described, I'm a high quality defensive manager, compare him against low vol or quality and see how he does then. Because what is very often the case is that managers who have attractive records over time have those records because they have been invested in a particularly good set of factors. Their stock selection ability may be negative.
Yeah.
And what the development of the index industry and the ETF industry has meant is that it's now possible to indicize those active strategies so that an investor can have access to the factors that deliver most of the return in a way that's transparent and cheap and easy to access and not be at risk of the manager's stock selections costing him money.
It's very interesting. I was making the point before we started this conversation that a lot of investors in Australia are managing pension assets, so they are managing their own money in retirement. I will say it's a drawdown strategy. It's not strictly true. A lot of Australian investors in retirement, self-managed super funds in particular, are very keen to preserve capital. So they're very conscious of longevity risk, but also actually in many cases keen to leave an inheritance and so on. So there's an estate planning component of it as well as a requirement to provide an income throughout their lifetime. And for those people, matching an index return for an accumulation index is just not as relevant as other factors, as you say. So it's interesting for those people to think about what factors they are trying to deliver to and whether there are ways they can
absolutely
indicize that process.
Low volatility or quality strategy would both be yield-oriented strategies would all be, I mean, if you think about factor indices generally, I think there are some that I will call often risk mitigators and some that are risk enhanced. Like momentum, for example, is a risk enhanced. Probably going to be more volatile than whatever you started out with. Mm. Low volatility is the quintessential risk mitigator. Mm. And so, I mean, I say this often to financial advisors and sometimes investors in the U.S. I mean, if you think about the time horizon that investors have, I mean, if the market's down 50% next year and I'm the Harvard endowment. That's okay. I'll reinvest my dividends cheaper. 100 years from now, I'll still be here, and you won't even see the 50% decline if you look at a chart of return. We don't see the 1987 crash when the market went down 25% in one day. If you look at a chart. On the other hand, for me personally, or for anyone who's drawing down his super fund, 50% decline is a lot. That's very significant. I'm not going to be here in 100 years,
so I need
to worry about a shorter time horizon. And what that means is that strategies that are able to indicize in the way that low vol does protect in down markets and participate in rising markets may be a better fit than the market as a whole, even if they don't outperform over time.
Craig, was there anything else that you wanted to add to this conversation? I love it, and I think the conversation about factor investing is really good. I hadn't actually planned on it, but it's really worthwhile because it's not something our investors are looking at closely. I think they'd get a lot of value from it.
Well, it's a new area. I mean, if you think about the evolution of indexing, as I said in the beginning, there were the all ordinaries in Australia. And that's how indexing started. That's where most of the assets are. And that's appropriate. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that this, as indices have developed over time and as the ETF business has grown, it's just possible to craft patterns of return in a way that may be more congenial to investors than simply accepting the index return. That said, for whether you're talking about a factor index or someone who does active stock selection, there's no natural source of outperformance. Mm. It's always the case that if I'm above average, somebody else has to be below average. If I outperformed, it's because someone else underperformed. The trick in factor indices is to know when you're likely to underperform. I'll give you a good example. In the US, the worst performing factor for the first 9 months of the year was low volatility.
Ah.
The growth was doing really well. Momentum was doing very well. All the more aggressive strategies were doing well. Was the market turned in October? As we go through now, into maybe 6 weeks rather of a downturn, not only is low volatility the best factor in that downturn, it's now the best factor year to date, the best performing factor year to date. That may or may not hold up, and it's completely irrelevant, really, whether it does or it doesn't. The important part is to say that investors who want the protection that low vol gives you have to be willing to accept the underperformance that it gives you when the market's doing well. If you're not willing to accept the underperformance, you don't want low volatility. It's analogous, I think, to something we said in the earlier podcast. We're talking about value investors. Value investors, buy things because they think they're cheap and undervalued and wait until they become more fairly valued or overvalued. If you're not prepared to be patient, don't be a value investor.
Mm.
Patience is a requirement. If you're not patient, you will do exactly the wrong thing at exactly the wrong time. But low vol, there's the analogy to low vol, or any factor, it's not just low vol. I mean, if you are a momentum investor, be prepared to underperform a lot at turning points in the market. Stocks that have been, there is a momentum factor. Lots of academic research. Stocks that have gone up historically tend to keep going up, and then one day they don't. And
yeah.
That day in the U.S. was in early October. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, growth and momentum turned around, and momentum and growth have underperformed dramatically in the fourth quarter so far. So that's not a condemnation of momentum. It's just an indication that if you want the good returns of momentum, be willing and aware that you have to accept the bad returns. And that the advice I think that you've given is most relevant to investors is be aware. Be aware.
There has been a proliferation of indices, in inverted commas, in very, one might even call them esoteric areas, and the products that they replicate are often designed around an index that didn't exist prior to the advent of the product. Any thoughts on those sorts of style?
There are a couple things. I think one is two main things. And we wrote about this some years ago in a paper called The Limits of History. And because an index of the sort you describe is going to be sold based on a simulated or back-tested history.
Yes.
An ETF is going to be sold based on that basis.
Now, the new products. Without wanting to name any names for a variety of reasons, they sound quite sexy and very interesting.
Yeah.
They tend to be in fields where people are seeing very dramatic growth, quite niche, and often not well tested.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of any in medicinal marijuana, but I wouldn't be surprised if one comes out.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. That would be an example.
I think they exist.
That would be an example of one where this sort of thing would happen.
Yeah, it's probably so the ticker is probably POT or something. I forget exactly, but no, they exist. What we said in our paper, I think, is good advice, and that is to realize if you are presented with a back test. Mm. There are some people who would say you should never trust back-tested information.
Mm.
And there's some good reasons for that. There's a good reason to be skeptical. But if you refuse to accept any back-tested information of any sort, you're basically refusing ever to consider a new idea.
Yeah.
So if we get over that, I think there are two things that are important to consider. One is, obviously, if the strategy is presented as having done better than the market index, better than the ASX 200, or better than the S&P 500. If that's the case, then ask yourself why. I mean, what is it about this index, this new concept, that justifies the outperformance? Mm. So, for example, I mean, there are, as we've discussed, some legitimate factor indices: value, momentum, low volatility, all of which were originally launched based on back tests. But at least there was an ability then to explain, well, the reason that this particular strategy does well is because it exploits some particular market inefficiency, or it exploits some behavioral tendency, or some combination of the two. If you can link to an explanation, that's a good thing. If you can't, my advice is don't do it. I mean, there's a famous page, now 20-some years old, in the U.S. called Stupid Data Miner Tricks. And one of the things that the guy that wrote the paper discovered was that the correlation, or the production of butter in Bangladesh, is highly predictive of the level of the S&P 500. So, and the correlation is there. If you only look at statistics, you'll see that. So the first thing is look for an explanation. The second thing is understand how the market environment affects the returns in the back-tested period. So for example, if you were looking at a very aggressive strategy in the year 2000, when you had just come through 10 years of a roaring bull market, you might, and didn't ask, what is the, is there something about the market environment in which this was tested? You might have decided, this is obviously a great strategy, whatever it is.
Yeah, a great time to buy a tech fund.
And then it would have gone off the cliff 10 years. Whereas if you looked at, say, a low volatility strategy in 2000, when it had underperformed for the last 5 years, you might say, well, this is kind of indifferent. I don't really like this, when it was about to do extremely well. Mm-hmm. So, and that's not to say that's an invariably good guide, but I think you should be aware of the way in which a factor index or any kind of active strategy interacts with the market environment, because if you're not aware, the danger is that you'll buy something that's particularly leveraged to a good market at a time when the market is good, or particularly defensive at a time when the market is bad, without realizing that's what you're buying. Mm. And I come back to, you know, ask those questions and you'll be aware of what it is you're getting.
Craig, brilliant conversation. You and your team produce some brilliant content. And it is, you know, so many of our guests produce brilliant content, but the research behind yours goes back a long way, and it covers a whole variety of fundamental concepts that investors may not be aware of, which is incredibly valuable. Where can people go to dig deeper into this?
There are two places that our listeners can go. One is our main S&P Dow Jones Indices website, which is www.spdji.com. And the other, less comprehensive, is our blog, which is called Indexology. That's actually not a word, but indexologyblog.com. And occasionally we'll write there, as some of my colleagues will as well.
Indexology is fantastic, having had a look at it. And for anyone listening, don't be intimidated by the term. The articles are quite short, less than a page.
Oh, yeah.
Very easy to read and friendly, and cover really brilliant snippy little sections of the market and areas that you may be wondering about.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely worth reading. Craig, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. It has been always wonderful to have you with us, and we hope it is helpful for you in your journey to becoming a better investor. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.